I am a human being and I killed human beings.
Before I knew it, I'd fired 4 shots at the door. I kept on shouting for Reva to phone the police.
Tests are underway to determine if a serial killer is on the loose in Centurion, Pretoria.
The dead won't bother you. It's the living you gotta worry about.
In a country marked by the harsh reality of 75 daily murders, these are the stories that echo through the reality of life in South Africa. Hello, it's Paul Llewellyn, and I'm delving into the minds of Africa's most evil, what drives them to commit unspeakable acts, and what does it take to bring them to justice. Leading the way on our journey is Gerard Labuschagne, an author, former law enforcement officer, and current head of LNS Threat Management. Labuschagne helmed the investigative psychology section of the South African Police Service from 2001 to 2016, working on over 300 cases of serial murder and rape. An internationally recognized and renowned, you will have seen him on television shows, whether it's from ENCA to documentaries around the world. Of course, author of The Profiler Diaries 1 and 2. Get those if you haven't read them. An expert in forensic psychology and so well plugged by Paul today. He is simply known as The Profiler. Good morning, Gerard. How are you?
Good morning, Paul, and good morning, listeners.
How's 2024 rolling out so far?
Pretty good. Still pretty good. Busy. New stuff. Interesting stuff coming in. So
totally. I'm enjoying 2024. I think there's a great energy out and about there. Please spread the word about the show. Share with your friends, colleagues, or anyone interested in crime in Africa. You can visit us at youtube.com/C/ProfilerAfrica. You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify. Just search for Profiler Africa. And you can follow us on Instagram at Profiler Africa. Join our Facebook group or drop us an email at profilerafricainfo@gmail.com. Get ready to explore some of the crime scenes and sift through the evidence, pics, and confront images of perpetrators and victims when we have them to share. So it's always nice to listen to the podcast and then go and check out some of the stuff that Gerard is talking about. Gerard, would you like to set the scene on today's case? Should we just dive straight into it?
Yeah, what I think is interesting is a topic that, I mean, it's prevalent everywhere. The issue of child molestation and human trafficking. But specifically, like, the sort of child molestation, paedophile stuff, it's like almost like a topic that a lot of documentaries really don't want to touch on, you know, unless it's Jeffrey Epstein. And then again, I mean, that wasn't little children. People just don't want to talk about paedophilia and child molestation. It's like people like crime, but they're kind of almost... it's uncomfortable, or they don't like hearing about that. And I can understand why, because it's got to do with little children. But they'll happily watch a documentary on a child murder, but you talk about this topic, and it's not one that even, like, I think production houses want to really... It's like not a nice, and I use that word in inverted commas, crime story to tell. But I do think it's a relevant one, and this one was the one that was prominent in the media. And I played a small role, which you can either talk about now or later, in this particular case. You know, I do also have the judgment. I did, well, perhaps I should say what my role was up front, because I don't think that was a secret. So this is the case of Gerry Ackerman, who was charged with like 700 and something counts. You know, it ranged from production of child pornography, distribution, benefiting from child pornography, human trafficking, recruiting young people to then become, you know, 16-year-old, 14-year-old kids to become masseurs, you know, massagists, whatever the right term is. Masseuses that obviously ended with sexual favors as part of that process.
So we kind of in Jimmy Savile turf here.
Yeah, that's sort of not nice people. So literally I said there were about 700 charges, a lot of it related to the pornography charges. But like I said, human trafficking, running a brothel with underage kids, and then he was charged with 2 counts of rape and attempted murder for sending off one of these kids to one of his clients who he knew was HIV positive, etc. So he was eventually convicted for all of these. And he was actually originally charged with another guy, Advocate Paul Kennedy, who was even an acting judge at some points. And Paul Kennedy was a very well-respected member of the legal community in Johannesburg. Paul Kennedy then committed suicide in the awaiting trial phase leading up to this. But eventually it was just Gerry Ackerman that went on to trial. So he was eventually convicted, and this is just, again, explaining my role. And Legal Aid then put out a request, you know, asking for psychologists prepared to do a sentencing report. Now, obviously, once you're found guilty, the next phase is sentencing, and often both sides would introduce evidence to help the judge make a decision. Now, what's interesting is that almost no psychologists, actually, except me, no psychologists wanted to even touch this case. And I guess it's in a way sad, because I think this is a case where you absolutely need good quality psychological evidence to assist the court to know what are the risks of this person, what can we do to try and, if possible, reduce any of those risks for when they do eventually come out, because everybody pretty much comes out. So no psychologists want to touch it. You know, even a colleague of mine used to work in the unit, and she did the Dross rapist case. Remember the guy who raped the little kid in the Dross? And she did a very good, competent report for sentencing purposes. I actually supervised her report. She asked me just to have some eyes on it and give her some advice. And it was a very good, well-balanced report. But you know, what the media reports and what the psychologist says is not the same thing. So what the media was reporting was almost making it sound like the psychologists, you know, the specific quote I'm trying to refer to is where she said, in just in a history gathering or background information gathering portion of a report, where the accused said to her, you know, if I go to jail for a long time, I'll kill myself. So in a process of that phase of a report where she's kind of just summarizing the interview, she mentions that. So what gets reported on, oh, psychologist says he shouldn't go to jail for a long time, because he'll kill himself, which is not what she said. And of course, if you look at the comments on News 24 or whatever the social media news outlets were, I mean, the comments were like absolutely attacking the psychologist, unfairly so, because the media didn't report accurately what she was commenting on. So I think a lot of psychologists don't want to be associated with this kind of a case.
Sounds quite par for the course for the media these days.
So they don't want to be associated, because a lot of these people who do forensic work, and there's very few people like me who just only do forensic work, so a lot of people have a private practice. So typically, what do you do when you thinking about going to see a psychologist? You Google them. I mean, that's what I do for services. You Google it, then you look at what the comments are. And of course, there often are these lambasting comments, are you help pedophiles. And I mean, if you're looking for a psychologist, you're going to go, I'll just maybe look for another one. So I understand why a lot of practicing psychologists don't want to touch these cases. Me, I don't have a private practice. I only do forensic work. I'm used to criticism in the courtroom and outside, so I'm fine with that. And I know as long as I'm giving family an honest, good opinion, not swayed by who's approached me to give an input, I'm going to do a good job. And I say outright to lawyers, I'm not guaranteeing you that my findings are going to be helpful to your client. I'll do my assessment honestly and well, you know, ethically, and it's not my problem if ultimately I find that your client's a raving psychopath, for example. And some lawyers don't phone me back and they go off to someone else, I guess. But ultimately, I was the only one that actually submitted a quotation to legal aid and it was accepted.
It does help here that you have a pre-existing relationship with the media as well. You know, I mean, people know you to a certain degree, I think a bit better than somebody maybe who doesn't have your public profile, which is, you know, just an interesting aspect. Given the fact that we kind of started with you talking about the fact that there's a discomfort around kind of addressing this kind of content, good to have a deep dive now through a case and interrogate the psychology aspect, because I think creating an understanding of the psychological influences here and what's at play kind of behind the scenes psychologically may help to alleviate some of that discomfort with people. Knowledge does tend to help you to kind of not be totally fearful of things, doesn't it? So, that said, interesting that obviously, if we kind of contextualize, that South Africa has a higher rate of sexual abuse against children, sexual violence against children than other parts of the world, so it's above the global average. There's an interesting 2019 study I found, which says that 19.8% of adolescents reported some form of sexual abuse. Boys 20%, girls 19% over their lifetime. 11.7% reported having been forced to have sex. This is according to a study called the Optimus Study. And it found that, like I say, the rate of sexual abuse in South Africa is higher than the global average. There were 24,387 sexual offences against children over that period. The majority of them rapes, and then some assaults, attempted rapes, contact sexual offences, etc. Just to contextualise, it is obviously a challenge. We know that GBV is a major issue in the country, and that obviously translates to children too. So where do we start here? Do we start with his background? Where is he from? What part of the world is he from? What was his childhood like?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've touched the charges. I mean, he was 57 at the time he went to trial. I'm just reading to the judgment here. There were 740 counts. Unlawful possession of child porn was a lot of them. Creating, producing, importing, procuring child pornography, distribution of it. Unlawful transactions, facilitating distribution, because he would paid for the child pornography he would send to his client, like Paul Kennedy. Trafficking. Benefiting from the services of child trafficking, facilitating on the premises child trafficking. It was, as I said, there were the two rape incidents, a sexual assault, sexual exploitation of a child. I'm just going to skip through some of the most core issues: grooming of a child, exposing children to pornography, attempted murder, etc. So that's what he ultimately, this was last year, I think his trial was finally concluded, if I recall correctly. Okay. So Gerry Ackerman himself, who was he? So he grew up he was born about 1969. So when I assessed him, he was 53. So the trial, the judgment was obviously a little bit before that, or when the trial started, when he was about 51, I think. You know, very normal household, no problems allegedly, no report of abuse. Otherwise, his father was a good upstanding member of the community, had been, I think, in the Air Force, became a construction, owned his own little business. I think mom was, I think, predominantly housewife, if I recall correctly, homemaker. Nothing disciplinary-wise, took a gap year after school, then went into his national services, like was the case in those days, and he was a medic for 18 months in the military. Then kind of did odd jobs, worked for his dad, studied film in Pretoria, I think it was a Technicon, dropped out after a year, went to Cape Town, started a little car radio sound shop for 2 years. It went well, apparently, then decided he's going to return up to the sort of Vol area. Friend that I interviewed said he was, nice, loyal guy, no problems. But in about 2000s, he relocated to Pretoria. And again, he's kind of just sort of doing odd things to keep himself going. So he starts one bread delivery service and a lawn care service, for about 2 years. Then he kind of manages a commune for students in the suburb of Lynnwood, which is a very nice suburb in the sort of more towards the east of Pretoria. So students, I guess, going to Tuckies, etc. And then he starts to live in a house in Menlo Park, where he was buying and selling secondhand vehicles. That was apparently doing very well for 2 years, around about 2012. And that kind of came to an end. I think there were some financial problems there with his business partner. And then he decides he's going to start up a massage parlor. This is about 2015, 2016, in that little house in Menlo Park. Apparently it was rented from a very well-known sports figure, which he didn't tell me exactly who, although I was quite curious. Mm-hmm. And he employed these sort of masseurs between the ages of 16 to 22. So his first sex service was actually in Pretoria. He actually had three in total. So the one that he's finally charged with in the charges I read out a moment ago was just the Johannesburg ones. So he starts off in like as a 2015, 2016. It's outright to, massages with happy endings and whatever else the kids are prepared to do, or the young masseurs. And that goes on for about 3 years. And it's actually doing very well. A lot of clients from Joburg coming through, etc. He ends up being in a car accident, which kind of the business almost then collapses. He gets behind on the rent, and the guy says, well, you got to move out. You're not paying your rent, et cetera, et cetera. He then decides, well, so many of my clients were from Joburg and from Sandton. Let me start up the business in Sandton. So he moves to Joburg about 2017, 2018, and he rents a house, quite a nice house in Sandton. He has about 5 to 7 masseurs staying with him at any given time. Again, 16 years, and some of them a bit older. Same kind of sexual services. And that goes on for about a year and a half. But what happens then is that, and this charge wasn't part of the main trial where I was involved. It is actually a charge and a trial that started way before this big thing that we all know Gerry Ackerman for. And this particular one, I think, was in Morningside at like an aquatic center. Essentially, he approaches a kid in the change rooms, and this, I think that he touched the child, or the child had to touch him. So he's arrested and I think taken to Alexandra Court. So that kind of smaller incident, not saying it's not significant, obviously it's a sexual offences incident, is kind of running in the background. But he gets arrested and he's in jail over the weekend. And apparently in between then the cops pitched up at the house and said to these young masseurs, all bugger off. And they apparently stole just about everything. So that whole business collapses. He's only in jail, I think, for the weekend. He's out on bail with that trial running in the background. He then
gives you a good sense of where his kind of where his feelings on this type of behavior.
Absolutely. And we'll get a bit more into that as my sort of involvement goes on. So he relocates to Sandringham. According to him, he said, "Look, I'm finished with this business now. I'm going to just, you know, do some buying and trading of secondhand goods, et cetera, et cetera." And then one of his clients, Paul Kennedy, phones him back and says, "Come on, can't you get me some child porn? Can't you get me a child?" And he kind of then, in the back of this property that he's staying in Sandringham, starts up a little massage parlor service again. So again, just the same thing, underage kids. Seems like these ones, though, were predominantly around about 16 years old.
Let's talk about consent quickly while you mention the age there. As I understand it, children under 16 cannot consent. How does that translate into kind of, and then not only consent, also, prostitution, etc.? Yeah.
So you have to look at different laws determine the age of consent for different things. Like, so consent to an operation, I think, is like 12 or 14. So you can consent to an abortion, but you can't consent to sex. So it kind of varies. But when I was in the Pretoria Public DPP's office, the Public Prosecutor's Office, on last week, actually, before we recorded this, for another case that I'm helping them with, I actually just said, I want to reconfirm this to make sure I'm just right, because I knew that question's going to come up. And essentially what I was told is that over 16, you can consent to sex with anybody, whether it's someone who's 90 years old, same age as you, etc. Between the age of 12 and 16, there can be consent, but the age difference between the two people involved cannot be more than 2 years. So if a 12-year-old and a 13-and-a-half-year-old, that's okay. Or I guess a 12 and a 14, that's okay. Or a 14 and a 16-year-old, you know, if that's the age range of the parties, that's okay. But a 14-year-old can't consent.
It's legal. It's not okay.
It's legal.
Yeah, right? It's kind of not encouraged.
Not encouraged. Yeah. But you know, a 14-year-old can't consent to have sex with a 53-year-old or a 15-year-old. Mm. Then it kind of falls in the old terminology, statutory rape, in the old kind of terminology. Okay. So over 16, you know, although I think that's a ridiculously young age, the law says 16 and above, you can consent to do sexual stuff with whomever you want to, as long as they, of course, can also consent. Mm. What's interesting, though, for child porn, anything under 18 is regarded as child pornography. So though you can consent at the age of 16, you sending a naked picture of yourself to someone else is child pornography.
Great.
Why I say there's different things. You have to be very careful.
Good.
And in terms of the Trafficking Act, anything under 18 is regarded as a child. So again, this isn't legal advice. Definitely go check these out from wherever you would find these out on from some act, etc., or statute.
Absolutely.
It did change. So that's kind of like where we stand in terms of consent.
Okay.
So as far as I know, prostitution is still illegal. I don't think much has been. It's not really being policed. I think it's kind of seen one of those crimes that the cops aren't really going to do much unless it's very obvious. And there's a whole debate about whether prostitution should be made legal. To be honest with you, I do think it should. We can't stop it, so let's try and regulate it to some degree and provide protection to people and some kind of industry standards, and that there's tax paid and there's some kind of legal protection. Because, of course, the minute it's illegal, you create a situation where those people can be abused by clients and the police. The minute it's legal, it changes the balance of it's a legal business. So it's the same as you going and being a cop sort of raiding a normal business for no real reason, trying to leverage them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So absolutely, that would be the sensible thing to do. And the kind of thing that South Africans do.
And I would imagine if they ever did.
The kind of thing that South African law does. I years ago around the World Cup time, we were filming and kind of talking about issues in preparation for the World Cup. Obviously, Cape Town is kind of one of the sex tourism capitals of the world, and one of the adult venues in Cape Town, we interviewed the owner there, and it was very interesting because he was saying, you know, they've got They've got property, flats, apartments near and attached and near to where this venue is. And there's a couple of hundred apartments. You know, it's like big blocks of flats, as far as I understand it. And this guy have basically had access at any time to like 200 visas, which he pretty much had kind of free rein of how he would navigate who has those visas to bring women in and out. Now, obviously, this was presented as 100% above board, and I've not done any. I don't know if there was any kind of actual prostitution going on. It was more of an exotic dance venue, but with lots of women, and you expect that, you know, the cynic in me suspects that there's probably other things going on behind the scenes. But just interesting that had that kind of access mm-hmm. to essentially manage himself, bringing women in and out mm-hmm. of the country, seemingly legally with visa, you know, with kind of work visas, etc.
Well, I mean, you know, I remember from that time in the police, most of these, you know, for lack of a better word, I'm sure there's a proper better word for it, sort of strip club type of places. It was not local. There were local people who were involved as dancers and stuff like that, but a lot of them were brought in, yeah. You know. So that's, and as you say, they're brought in with some other, you know, job title. Yeah. But that's, I mean, and so honestly, yeah,
I must be honest, the kind of the trafficking part of the kind of sex mm. industry really gives me the heebie-jeebies just thinking about it in a South African context. You know, doing what we do and talking about what we talk about, I just dread to think how bad it is. You know, you hear those stories of like 400 kids being caught on buses coming down from Zim. Now, I know that's possibly just kind of families trying to sneak their kids in for Christmas. But, you know, just the fact that that can, you know, when you're picking it, when you're finding 400 kind of unaccompanied children on a couple of buses, you know, imagine what the illicit, whether that's illicit or not, imagine how relatively easy it is for the illicit side of the trade to bring people in and out of the country. And I'm pretty sure it's probably a bit dodgy to really talk about it in any detail, because you're just asking for trouble, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, so jumping back to Gerry Ackerman, actually.
Yeah, that's what I thought you were going to say. That's what I thought.
So
jumping back to Gerry Ackerman, anyway, sorry.
Yeah, so the third, basically the charges that we all know him for or relate to when he is now, the third sort of little operation he was running, which was in Sandringham, which is kind of Norwood, Sandringham, that kind of general area. So my knowledge of Joburg on that side is not. It's, you know, a perfectly nice area, etc. As I said, you know, Paul's background, nothing really interesting. He did, said that, you know, what's his preference? You know, he said, you know, once or twice in his younger times, he dated girls.
So Gerry or Paul here?
Gerry.
Sorry, you just said Paul. So yes, Gerry. We are talking about Gerry. Yeah, sorry.
You know, when he was in primary school, he had a girlfriend, and then later on after school.
Yeah.
Okay.
He was, you know, quite experimental with his sexuality from a relatively early age.
Yeah, you know, he did describe at primary school he had one sort of voluntary consenting same-sex experience. He kind of then says, but by the age of about 2002, he kind of decided he's just going to have a sexual interest in males. He kind of had a preference for what they term twinks, which is essentially young people, kind of, I guess, depending what definition is, like between 16 and 20 is kind of what a twink age roughly is. But typically twink means that it's a very slim, effeminate person, very boyish looking, no body hair, no facial hair, very young. So that he said in his own words was his preference in terms of partners. He said the youngest person he ever did have sex with was a 24-year-old person when he himself was 50 years old. So, and at the time of his final incarceration, he was dating a 19-year-old person who was a drug addict. So the thing for me, there's always this discrepancy in terms of I'm much more older and established than the people that he's sexually involved in. So there is, for me, even though it's consenting, you know, if it's in the consenting age, if you're 20, 30 years older than the person, you know, it's different when it's a 70-year-old and a 50 or 40-year-old. But when you've got, you know, a 50-year-old and a 17-year-old, I don't care if it's legal, that is still a power relationship that is not of equality. And basically, you know, he had this mindset that, you know, he even felt that the age of consent should be 13. He actually, you know, stated that to me. And, you know, how can any form of love be wrong? which was what he said. And he just kind of said, you know, these kids were over the age of consent. So if they're engaging in sort of sexual services through the massage parlor, what's wrong with that?
Mm. You know, I've heard the kind of the argument there as, you know, historically, humanity, when a human reaches the age of sexual maturity, then sexual activity is, you know. And I would imagine that for hundreds of thousands of years, that's how we have evolved as a species. I mean, I wasn't around then, I'm not sure. I can't speak definitively. That said, what is it about society in the last couple of hundred years, post-industrialization kind of thing, that has raised the age of consent?
Well, I mean, there are some countries in Europe that still have a very low, much lower than our age of consent. So there's always that, I guess there's always going to be in certain countries across the world of different legal views on when is it okay and when isn't it. And like you say, people often, specifically these types of child molesters, will often say, but in Roman times, it was normal for an older man to guide a younger man. Well, we're not in Roman times. And the Romans had a lot of other things too that we would be are quite horrified by today.
Would you consider any, I don't know, you know, is there a predisposition psychologically among certain people? Because historically as a species, a part of our, you know, our culture or society has allowed that kind of behavior. You know, is there maybe a roll on psychologically from, you know, some kind of a genetic thing that you can, that's hereditary, some kind of hereditary psychological behavior? I don't know.
There's lots of different sort of theories about why, and I don't think we really know why. Why does anybody have certain sexual preferences and interests? Like, why does one person like tall woman with big breasts, another person likes tall woman redhead with small breasts or short or this? And what people like to do sexually with their partners. So that's, we don't quite know why people end up having certain sexual interests and attractions. Why are some people gay? Why are some people bisexual? Why are some people not, etc. So I don't think we have a great excuse, you know, but almost all cultures have a definite point where too young, there is a too young age.
Absolutely.
What often finds is this debate about what is that cutoff period,
yeah,
you know, and that's, you know, is it biologically with puberty? Is it this? Is it psychological, etc.? So that's where you find the gray area, and that's what I mentioned. Now, different countries have different age levels, and we even, as I said, amended ours to some degree, you know, not too long ago. So the debate becomes, when is it? But I think every culture will have a point where it says it's too young, and there will be a too young point. Again, I mean, we typically refer to people who have a sexual interest in prepubescent children, generally 13 years or younger, as being pedophiles.
Yes.
That's a psychological or psychiatric term, not a diagnosis. It doesn't excuse them of their behavior. So in court, you're not going to get, it's actually an aggravating factor if you are diagnosed as a pedophile. It's not a sort of a, oh, shame, that's going to count for you to be diagnosed as a pedophile.
Okay.
Because we know we can't also change that.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a high risk increasing factor, which means there's greater risk for people reoffending, and we can't, no matter what people say, you can't fix that behavior.
Because the law is not just about punishment, it's also about protection of the community.
Yeah, and sentences sentencing is about, you know, punishment, retribution, sending a message to society, sending a message to this person, the offender, rehabilitation, prevention of them doing it again by rehabilitation, etc. So sentencing looks at all these various factors.
Now here's a question, is it illegal to be a pedophile?
So it's not illegal to be a pedophile. So you get a lot of pedophiles that have these sexual interests in prepubescent children. It's a relatively fixed interest. But they might be at home, masturbate, thinking about a prepubescent child. So they never, ever download child pornography or watch child pornography. They don't approach and try and touch a child, etc. So they're not doing anything illegal. So no, it's not illegal to be a pedophile. And you don't get charged with being a pedophile when you do something, because that's, again, a psychological diagnosis. You get charged for sexual assault if you were to touch a child. And the fact that it's a child would just add an additional aggravating factor to that charge.
So if you keep it in your head.
And keep it in your pants.
And keep it in your pants.
And your hands in your pockets.
And your hands in your pockets, and you don't, and your internet offline.
Yeah.
Then,
you know, and you do get a lot of people who say, look, I have these interests. I know they're wrong.
Yeah.
And I don't want to do anything about it. And so they go to the psychologist and say, look, I just want you to help me keep myself on track. That's a healthy situation, because that person understands that this is, they don't want to act upon it. they know it's wrong, they want to help be managed, that they just don't go out and offend. That's great. Then you've got someone who's getting that psychological intervention and support. We're not going to change those feelings, but we're keeping that person on track from actually offending by committing some kind of crime, by acting out on those feelings.
See, this is why talking about subjects like this in detail is a positive thing, because something like that is a great understanding where the line lies between a psychological disorder and it crossing over into actual criminality is important. You know, there are people who have these feelings, I'm sure, who spend a lifetime trying to positively, proactively deal with them in a constructive way, where there's a self-awareness about these feelings, they're able to navigate their life in society, not committing any illegal acts, not downloading anything appropriate, not, like you say, keeping it in your pants. And it's important to understand that as a community, is that there's an aspect of embracing this as a psychological issue that we as a society must acknowledge and accept and have and deal with, as opposed to just let's not talk about it.
And just two important things that I'd like to mention. The first thing is, not all pedophiles are only interested in children. So actually, part of the diagnosis, is it exclusive, meaning you only have an interest in prepubescent children, generally 13 years or younger? Or are you non-exclusive, meaning you have these interests or urges towards prepubescent children, but you also are capable of having urges and interests in adult male or females? Yeah. Doesn't mean you're less of a pedophile, it just means you're a non-exclusive pedophile. So you can get a lot of people who still are able to engage adults with sexual behavior, and hopefully that will, at least in terms of sexual urges, you know, keep it on the line of okay, legal. Another thing I often see in psychologists when they do testify in these cases, they might say, and this is not relevant to Ackerman's case, but I just think it's relevant to the topic, is that they'll often say, well, this guy just looked at child pornography, or this guy, you know, he didn't touch a child, he just looked at children naked, so he's not a pedophile. And that's definitely wrong. If you're a psychologist out there who think that, read the definition again. It's about thoughts, urges, or behaviors, or thoughts, fantasies, urges, or behaviors. So that's why I say, if someone tells me I have these urges towards prepubescent children of sexual interaction, I've had them for quite a long time, 6 or more months, you can make the diagnosis of pedophilia, because it doesn't require you to have touched a child. So that's just also something I just want to point out, because I've just seen a lot of psychologists who say that nonsense in court. Or, you know, he only molested children when he's drunk, he's just an alcoholic. And that's like absolutely wrong. You don't understand the topic that you're dealing with.
So Kheri's thinking that 13 is A-OK is a key to a whole lot of criminality for him. And picking up from
there. So I mean, he just has a general attitude that he hasn't done anything wrong. So what he actually kind of is, let's go right into what he said about the offenses. He denies that he raped anyone. He says that he did have sex with these two separate masseurs. If I recall clearly, they were both 16, just over 16 years old. But he said it was consenting. All right, so he denies he raped. He said that was consenting sex with the 16-year-olds. The child pornography that they found on his computer and I think on his phone, he says, nope, that was... that was the some of the kids that worked for him downloaded that and put it on his phone. So he denied that it was his pornography. And the pornography ranged from quite young kids, you know, below, definitely below 16, definitely within the age range of pedophilia's definition. Then there was also an incident from 2007 and 2009 at Dagamas Kloof, which is there in near Mossel Bay. It's like a camping thing along the coast. What do you call it? Caravan park type of setup. Where twice in those 2 years, 2007, 2009, he exposed himself in the change rooms, you know, walking around with an erection, etc. Didn't touch any kids, thank goodness. And he was noted twice in 2007, 2009. He said, no, that was nothing sexual. I was just in the showers. And then besides the one we mentioned at the beginning of this case where he was picked up and taken to court in Alexandra, in this trial we're speaking about now, there was another incident at an aquatic center where he basically had exposed himself, had an erection in the change room, a little boy was there, and he was taking a video. And so he denied that again, that that was not what happened. So basically, he acknowledges that he did facilitate pornographic pictures of kids, but he thought the age of consent was 16, therefore these kids could consent to engaging in sending nude pictures. Well, again, the Child Porn Act says no.
So, but he didn't know Gerard. Surely then they
so can't. Unfortunately,
ignorance is no excuse.
There's almost no examples in South African law. There's like one very rare example where ignorance is an excuse. Okay. Unfortunately, they expect that you. Otherwise, everybody would say, "I just didn't know."
Yeah. So, just as a quick aside, while we're talking about kind of this capturing of child exploitation kind of video, and you know the proliferation of video in our lives today compared to at any point in history, and how you know we all have a very high quality phone typically at our fingertips, or camera rather at our fingertips. There was a thing that happened a few years ago, I remember, and it was, I think around the Western Cape, kids filming themselves having sex. And this was kind of stuff that went viral.
Yep.
And people were sharing it amongst each other. Where's the law lie there when it comes to, I'm on my whatever group on WhatsApp and suddenly there's something that's going viral. It's featuring two 14-year-olds having sex in a bathroom somewhere, and it's now popped up on my WhatsApp.
Yeah.
Am I now a child pornographer?
So basically, again, if you are under 18, you filming yourself or yourself with someone else who's under 18, so either you're filming yourself engaged in this activity or someone else engaging in this activity sexually, if that person is under 18, you've just produced child pornography. It doesn't matter if it's just for you. The minute you send that to someone else, you have distributed child pornography. So you're in possession of, you've created, you're in possession of, and you've distributed child pornography. It doesn't matter if it's your own material. And the minute that gets put on a group, if you're on that group, you should say, guys, this is illegal. This, I'm getting off this group, and you go to the nearest police station. Because there's a lot of case law that, for example, people have
these... This is a guy, say, you've known 30 years, buddy, and he's shared it on the group.
You know why? Because there's a lot of...
deleting it is not...
Delete it off your phone
and
get off that group immediately and ideally say, this is illegal, I'm getting off of this group. Okay. I don't condone this. You know why? Because a lot of case law about people who badmouth each other on these groups or on Facebook, like a WhatsApp group or whatever groups you're on, or mass emails. Paul is such a this, that, and the other, and he's less. And do you know that he goes on the weekends and does this and this? If you don't distance yourself from that and you don't leave the group, the law says you're just as much guilty as a person who posted that.
Okay.
So if you tag it, if you forward it, even if you are just as much guilty. So that's why you need to get off that group, say this is wrong, I'm getting off here, and the best way to protect yourself is to report to the police.
Okay.
Otherwise, like I said, if you're on that group, it stays there, etc., and you don't do anything, technically, legally, you are all complicit as the person who dropped it into that group in the first place.
Well, that is good information for everyone out there. So just be aware of that. You have to be hyper-vigilant about these things.
So even if, like I said, if you're bad-mouthing someone, that is regarded as defamation. And if you don't distance yourself, you are now technically... can be charged just as much as the other person who posted that originally.
Bit of banter is okay, though.
Yeah.
Bit of banter, fine.
Well, be careful.
We're moving into. I can't live in a world with no banter.
And then people like Emma Sadlier does wonderful talks about this and the risks of there's a lot people just don't understand about social media and are misconceiving
A focused episode on this. Maybe there's a case or two to help illuminate. I mean, you know, more so than this that can really tackle some of the wide-ranging issues that, and we can give people some really good solid advice on how to best educate themselves when it comes to making sure that you're safe in a digital
and that
social
your kids
media
aren't doing
environment.
Stuff that's going to get them to a lot of trouble, naively so,
yeah,
but a huge amount of trouble.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's such a such an important thing to consider navigating as a parent. It's such a complex issue, isn't it? This kind of connectivity.
Overall, Carrie's view was, I haven't done anything wrong. These kids were over 16, although there was one that was 14. I've helped out people in need. You know, a lot of these kids were rejected by their families when they told their families they were gay. Some of them were in proper sex work. I brought them into sort of something lesser severe, you know, massage work with a happy ending, as they say. You know, and I gave them a place to stay. I gave them money, you know. They would make a few hundred rand off every interaction, every massage. And he couldn't quite see that. And he said, look, and also have a rule, no penetrative sex. So happy endings, if they wanted to, that's what he said, was the end of the story. But he couldn't quite see that, you know, introducing kids into the sex trade is psychologically harmful to them. You're placing them into harm's way physically, from literally being assaulted, to obviously, you know, their health issues, physical health issues, contracting sexually transmitted illnesses. And I mean, you just mess kids up if you put them at this age into this kind of stuff. I think for any sex worker, there's going to be psychological effects at the least. Yeah. And couldn't see that, no, helping them doesn't mean introducing them into a sex trade so they can buy stuff. That's not actually helping them. And couldn't quite get that because he felt, well, but these are 16-year-olds, so they can do this anyway.
You know, in your experienced opinion, what's the feasibility that somebody can go through life into adulthood not having a sense from society at large of the boundaries, the clear boundaries when it comes to things like child sexual abuse, and that the fact that you've got even a 16-year-old in this kind of environment is definitely going to be something that, you know, I mean, any normal person should consider that that's going to be, going to really have an impact on that person, and not probably a positive impact. What are the chances that somebody goes through life just oblivious to where these boundaries lie?
You know what? It's one, probably, I'm going to give you a stat that I have no idea whether it's true, like 1 in 100,000. Kerry Ackerman is 1 in 100,000. So they exist out there. And I said he was convicted and he still said, there's nothing wrong with this.
Yeah.
You know, that mindset was still, nope. Besides me getting the age when the people can send their own child porn on wrong, which I understand now the law says something different, this is not wrong.
And it's interesting, you know, it speaks to this thing. It's like, you know, the one thing that's been on my mind a lot lately when it comes to just illegality in South Africa, just general kind of, and just the general state of society, is the fact that if you don't, you know, like everything, we'll use the building the house analogy. Mm. Good house needs a solid foundation, doesn't it? Now, the foundation in society, so that we can live together in an amicable, as peaceable a manner as possible, is that we all kind of buy into a contract of certain fundamental things that kind of align with our basic ethics and principles. Mm. You know, things like not weeing on the side of the road facing oncoming traffic. You know, just... sure, we've all got to have a wee when we're out in public sometimes. But hide behind a tree. Mm. Don't do it on the side of a main road where there's ladies jogging up and down, for example, you know, and kids are exposed to male genitalia. Kind of, you know, I feel like my son sees male genitalia twice a week driving to school and back, because there's some, you know, things like that. Traffic. If you're sitting on the highway, that yellow lane is an extra lane. Now, that is an emergency lane. It's for safety personnel. It's for police. But obviously, taxis majority. But everyone will be down that yellow lane. These basic... because here, Kheri is holding on to his beliefs in the face of being shown the book. No, look, here's the law, China. Mm. Okay? It says no. So it's illegal. It's bad. So you can feel and think however you want. But the law says you've got to do this. And for us all to get along and to be cool with each other... and to be happy in society, you've got to buy into this. You know, and it seems to kind of, for me, it's like this thing in South African society right now where we just, the foundation is a bit wobbly because people are just not willing to go, you know what, I'll wait in traffic for a little bit longer. I'll just stay in the queue. I'm not going to cut down the lane or cut in front at the front, at the robot there, at the road. Do you get what I'm saying? I mean, it's a bit of a left turn from the conversation, but it's just about this. What is it about people that they are still able to overlook what clearly should is in everyone's best interest?
I mean, it's a difficult one to answer. I mean, some people like him, he's like I say, he's just his mind developed that way, and he just doesn't see that there's anything wrong with this. And we call those cognitive distortions in this type of case, where you just can't see that this is wrong.
And you've just viewed it that
you've explained or convinced yourself that this is okay, and you've come up with your 101 reasons, but in Roman times, et cetera, et cetera. And he just kind of sticks with this thing, you know what? If the law says I can have sex with a 16-year-old, there's nothing wrong with it. But actually, morally, there is too. You know, we have to separate. The law says one thing. So you can do a lot of things that are legal, but they're really horrible, horrific, disgusting things. Like you can have sex with 1,000 women a day. I don't think that's morally right. I don't think it's a good idea. I don't think it's something positive we should encourage. So they're like, well, you know what? Doesn't matter if I'm 50-something. I can have sex with a 16-year-old as long as they consent, which legally, yes, but most of us would say, but morally, no, actually. It's still actually morally wrong.
Absolutely. This is the thing. I guess it's just that once you start to allow just the very most basic illegality to happen, it seems to be a brief, it seems to enable the scary illegality, this kind of stuff. Child sexual abuse, it just seems to create a more fertile ground and an environment for that kind of illegality. You know, and if you're not, if we're not policing ourselves on the little things, and, you know, our culture is about policing each other, and that's what the police themselves see every day, and they take it into their daily tasks, and they apply that moral, that moral standard, and it helps to deflate the really bad stuff that is allowed. You know, that's how I see it. So I don't know. Maybe it's just...
I guess you can say it's like the broken window thing. If you allow small things to happen, the next, you know, then the next line of bad things, or the next things to fall, and so on and so on and so on. Yeah. So I do think so. And if we kind of ignore the people just driving through the red lights and are doing the thises, then, you know, then it's speeding at 180, then it's this, then it's that, then it's parking facing the wrong direction in the road. That really drives me up the wall, by the way.
Absolutely.
And then it's like, oh, I don't have to pay taxes, I don't have to do this. It's like, it's just, you kind of...
It's just like an illness, creeping
borders of where what is okay to do. Because if we don't do all these things, then it doesn't matter if we don't do these things either. So so in terms of him getting caught, as I recall correctly, one of the kids that he kind of trafficked over, that he ended up, I think one of the kids he ended up having sex with, which the child says was rape, went and reported it. And the cops pitched up at Harry's venue and then arrested him, and obviously just unfolded the whole thing. Because a lot of kids knew each other, some of the kids were staying there, etc. So then it all kind of tumbled out. So essentially someone coming forward.
Yeah.
That's often how these things are only going to get solved, sadly. So like I said in the beginning, I had some, a little involvement. So I was tasked, as I said, to do the assessment. I went and saw Harry Ockham numerous times, about four times in the prison. I went to the documentation, etc. Drafted my report and gave it to his legal representative, and he was very competently represented by Herman Alberts from Legal Aid. And I also warned Alberts, I said, look, you know, I've looked at the judgment. I can't, you know, there's a very good chance that my findings, if I look at the judgment, are not going to be helpful to your client. And he said, he just needs a good, honest opinion. I said, well, great, because I'm pretty good at doing good, honest opinions. Yeah. So I drafted my report. He then I gave it to his legal representative, who went to go see Harry Ackerman in jail, and Ackerman refused to accept my results because I was saying some things that we've discussed in this show that I can't say now, that weren't going to be in his favor.
Yeah.
You know, I think the prosecution would have loved my report, let me put it that way.
Okay.
So essentially, as soon as his client says, no, you can't use this report, his legal representative's hands are tied. And there's court decisions that also say they can't be forced to hand over the report. There's sort of judgments about that. So that was that. So I was never called as a witness. However, who was called is Colonel Kristen Clark from my old unit in the investigative psychology section. She's kind of my, basically in the role that I used to be in to some degree. She's now based in Pretoria. She'd been in Cape Town for a number of years. She did come and testify. And she called him a pedophile based on what he'd done. And also that he was a serial rapist, because we had two separate incidences of rape. I've got no problem with how she's described him. As you say, he then ultimately got 12 life sentences. So a lot of the human trafficking stuff leads to very, very serious life sentences. And of course, the two rapes, etc., would be leading to life sentences. Now, remember I mentioned that other trial the one from Alex, the very first one. Now, in the background, that case is running separately. It couldn't be added to this big trial because it was already on the go. If it hadn't yet, they could have consolidated that like they consolidated all these cases, you know, the 2007 and 2009, the Gamma's Corp, Caravan Park incidents, etc. So after he's convicted and sentenced for these that we've just been discussing, he got the 12 life sentences, that conviction, that trial finally finishes. He's found guilty of touching a child at the aquatic center. He got a very small sentence, if I recall from my Google search, because I wasn't involved in that particular case. You know, a year, I think it was, even for that incident. But I think the importance of that incident, that kid was 11 years old. So there we had a hands-on offense with a prepubescent child. So here, I think Colonel Clark's reason why she called them pedophile is that, A, one of the kids was about 14, which is kind of on that cusp of prepubescence, mm-hmm. is child pornography. A lot of it was prepubescent children, so that's, again, enough of a reason to define pedophilia. And also the cases from Da Gama's Corp was a 7-year-old and 9-year-old where he exposed himself. But now this Alexandra trial was an actual hands-on offense with an 11-year-old. So it kind of, in a way, reconfirms, I guess, Colonel Clark's findings of, you know, that he's a pedophile, and of course the serial rapist was confirmed by the two separate rape cases in his big trial. So that was, in a way, some, I guess you could say, some vindication for her, just another vindication to say, and we had that other conviction of an 11-year-old that came after this big trial. That sentence won't affect his overall sentence because he's got the 12 life sentences, and as we know, they'll all start on the same day, ticking down. Sadly, it does mean in 25 years he will have his first parole hearing, which I've always thought is just ridiculous, that having multiple concurrent running sentences for different crimes doesn't actually extend your length of time. And I honestly think, you know, we should get Parliament to change that. If you have, like in this case, multiple different incidences, even if you've got life sentences for 12 separate incidences, that life sentence number 2 only starts a year and a half, 2 years into your sentence. And life sentence number 3 starts another 2 years after that. Mm-hmm. So you at least are pushing that parole period a bit longer in a way, because that sentence will start a bit later.
Yeah, the judge was very clear. He was like, you are evil and you should never be allowed to be around children ever again. Mm-hmm. But like we know, the reality is that on good behavior, 20 years, the guy's out. He, you know, if his moral compass hasn't shifted, he's the kind of person that could come back into society at some point. And yeah, that's just has to something that just seems to need to be addressed, isn't it?
I mean, and the risk things here, I mean, A, you have this long-standing behavior, the pedophilia, which is an underlying driver of this behavior. You have vulnerable victims that he took advantage of by helping them, and I use that in inverted commas for people who are on podcast. He smoked a lot of marijuana. His income, essentially, for years, had been from this industry. So, and this cognitive distortion that this is okay. And that makes huge risk concerns.
There's probably not too many crimes that he could have committed in this landscape that he didn't. You know what I mean? Yeah. He did a bit of everything, didn't he? And somebody who is able and capable to do that. It's a Jimmy Savile type scenario. It's that big. It's that important. It's that impactful. And had Jimmy Savile been caught at a young age, he would never have been let out of prison in the UK, for example.
And because his preference... We can
translate that this guy should not be let out of prison at any point.
And ever. If you look, because of his... It's always vulnerable young people. I mean, you don't have to be very strong. He's not grabbing and forcing people down like the typical serial rapists do.
Yeah.
So he can continue with this kind of behavior till he's very old, because he's taking financial advantage of vulnerable people.
Yeah.
So that interest is never going to go away, unfortunately. Yeah.
And I'm sure the prison environment, from a sexual point of view and sexuality and that interaction of prisoners, is quite a complex, you know, it's probably not something that is going to assist in any kind of potential rehabilitation. Yeah. If anything, it's the kind of environment that's going to, you know, enable, maybe.
Well, let me put it this way. As long as he's got that cognitive distortion that I didn't do anything wrong, he's not going to want... putting him through a rehabilitation course is going to be pointless, because he'll just be going, I'm wasting my time, I didn't do anything wrong. He has said that he wants to appeal. He was very unhappy with his legal representative. Didn't think he fought properly for him, but I just don't think Harry Ackerman understood what the law says.
Yeah.
You know, your thoughts don't equate to more important than the law.
Yes.
And I think that's his biggest problem. You know, you can't say if the, you know, child porn, if they're over 16, how can it be child porn if they're under 18? And he's just like, no, that doesn't make sense. Well, it doesn't matter if it makes sense. That is what the law says. Exactly. So, you know, I don't think his appeal will be at all successful. Mm. And as I, my experience of his legal representative is very competent, and I think a very honest legal representative, because he, as I said, when I told him, look, there's a very good chance my evidence is not going to be in your client's favor. And he said, I just need an honest opinion. Okay. So he's a very honest and experienced legal representative, the kind you actually want to be working in legal aid.
Yes.
So.
And to be an ethical, that doesn't mean you, because you are defending somebody, it doesn't mean that you... that you agree with what
they did. And that's what I really want to point out, and I think we've touched on it once or twice, is that the system would be far more of a problem if we didn't have people representing accused people. Mm-hmm. If we had people, whenever an accused person represents himself, it's an absolute disaster for the criminal justice system.
Yeah.
For the victims, they don't understand the law, they are inappropriate. It's really not a good idea. So we really do need, whether it's privately paid lawyers or legal aid lawyers, in the majority of criminal cases, it's legal aid lawyers defending people. Not a lot of people do private legal work, and it costs a lot of money for an accused person to pay for that.
Yeah.
So we really do. And of course, you get ones out there who just think, I'm going to do my best to get this guy off, even though I know he did it. Those are, of course, the unethical ones. But we really do need legal representation. It makes things a million times easier for the process of justice to go forward.
Mm.
So we shouldn't be attacking and angry and going after them and making them lives and discouraging people from representing accused people. We actually do desperately need that.
Absolutely. There is no yin without the yang, and neither the yin or the yang are really bad. Mm-hmm. They're both required in part order for the system to all
be whole,
to be balanced, mm-hmm. isn't it? A very interesting case. What are your kind of key takeouts from this case, other than the fact that, you know, legal representation of, you know, somebody representing these types of offenders needs to be given. Those people, there needs to be much more, you know, we shouldn't be criticizing those people. They're just doing their job.
Sure. Well, I mean, obviously anything that can improve our ability to pick up the kids who are being put into these situations. But it's, you know, I think we actively have to have people who are going onto sites, trying to find people offering services that look dodgy, checking them out if they are. We can't just sit back and wait for somebody to come forward somewhere and with information.
Yeah.
You know, clients found these places. You know, he used to advertise, definitely the Pretoria branch that he had was advertised on a website for massage services.
Mm.
You know, with kind of, you could tell that this was younger people.
Yeah.
And that should always be looked into by the police.
Absolutely.
Again, sex work is illegal. But definitely when you've got young people, it's implied in the terminology used. The cops should be actively looking for those and then going and doing a project to see what's going on there or to disrupt the operation, if anything.
Yeah.
Not just sitting back and waiting for somebody to come forward. Like, yeah, we had one kid who eventually came forward and that got to the police and that unraveled this whole years-long activity that he had been engaging in.
Yeah. I think that what we need to do is to address some stories that are very much kind of related to children and the plight of children in South Africa. I think it's something we can give some attention to, because there are lots of issues that young people confront these days, and you know, we can do our little bit to educate and inform whoever's listening.
And what's, if you think about also, most often in these cases, who have we got here on trial? It was the guy running the brothel and Advocate Paul Kennedy, who was a client stroke, almost you could say a benefactor of Harry's little business because it suited him. What about the people who used the services?
No, exactly.
I don't know. I wasn't involved in the investigation. So how much effort was to check his phone log? So he would have, obviously appointments would have been made and said, right, we're going to go after these guys that actually came here for services.
What a, you know, it's, when you have access to a hub of potential pedophiles, sex offenders, say, or people who are skirting the law on these things, then you should see that as an opportunity to investigate that web and chase down all those leads. I wonder what was done in that regard, if anything.
Yeah. I mean, I honestly think, besides, you know, people trolling the webs, you know, massage service websites looking for things that could be dodgy. I do think we should even go to the extent, I don't know what the law says about this, so please take that with a pinch of salt. We should see whether it's legal to set up sites that imply such services are offered. And although you can't, you know, you want, obviously you're not going to offer the services, but then people contact and say, you know, actually this is the police, purely because then people will be very scared about contacting these websites because they're like, I don't know if this is a real one or this is the cops.
Yeah,
if anything, might deter a bunch of people when that gets out, and that should be made public that the cops have done that, or we've, you know.
Oh, really?
And like I said, not you might not be able to prosecute anybody, but you know, you could say
it's a good way to start figuring out where the issues are in amongst the community. You can start source of finding people, and it can be a catalyst for an investigation into somebody or the start of an investigation into someone. I think trafficking is something we should talk about. You know, give some thought if there's any of your buds or any particular cases that really kind of address the issue of trafficking and the sex trade just generally in South Africa.
Because it's a term that is often misunderstood. We often think it's people put in chains, smuggled across the border. Majority of trafficking isn't taken, like that. Here, why he had trafficking charges was because he met most of these little kids on Facebook, usually with a bit of a fake profile, one or two on Grindr, and then he would say, hey, chat, this, that, the other, and eventually, like, you know, oh, the kid might say he's unhappy, so, well, I've got a job, you can earn lots of money. He would then pay for them to take a bus to Johannesburg, depending on how far away they were. I think somewhere in Bloemfontein. Other ones, when they got to the bus station, he'd arrange an Uber to come drop them off at his place.
Sure.
Or just he would, you know, if they were close enough through his conversations on Facebook, he would then Uber them over. And that's where the trafficking part came, that he brought them to this place for the purposes, and of course then very often housed them you know, for periods of time while they were working for him. So that's where the trafficking element, and that has, I think, got him some life sentences.
I dread to think how prevalent this kind of behavior is, and it would be nice to get a sense of it, so we must give it some thought. We'll discuss it offline and see if we can come up with an episode or two to address these types of things. Thank you, Gerard, again for a great episode. Very interesting discussion. Again, I think maybe 2024 we can kind of have a particular focus on illuminating stories related to children and to young people, just because that is the, you know, they are the future. And, you know, like they say, you know, they are the future. And the more we can do to kind of lay the foundation, they're the foundation, so let's make sure that we're kind of protecting and looking after them so that they can set a good example for the generations to come. And I don't have to see people weeing on the side of the road so much, for example. Thank you, Gerard. Have you got a good week coming up? Any interesting cases you're busy with?
I've just been asked by Legal Aid, actually a human trafficking case where a young lady was trafficked herself and then later on became kind of like a brothel owner or manager, and was convicted. So again, Legal Aid has asked me to do an assessment there, so that's one. I still have to go see that young lady for sentencing purposes. What else? It's documentary stuff.
Yeah, lots of true crime being
recording
being
for the
Hayes Hunert
True Life Drama again, which I don't know how many people here listen to watch Afrikaans TV, which I'm still a regular feature on that show. But yeah, so actually, that's some interesting
stuff.
Yes,
that's right. Gerard can be Gerard or Gerard.
Gerard, please. I know.
Whichever.
I get that a lot. I mean, I accept it. With the surname like Labaskagni, people
look,
assume that
when,
Gerard is
when
actually
when we first met, I'm driving to Pretoria to meet you there by St. Julian. I see Gerard Labaskagni. I'm expecting Gerard. I was expecting Gerard. I was ready for Gerard. I came with Gerard. I left with Gerard. Thank you very much. We'll chat again soon. Spread the word about the show. Share with your friends, colleagues, or anyone interested in crime in Africa. Visit us at youtube.com/C/profile Africa. You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, Google Podcasts, the lot. It's not hard to find us. Just search Profiler Africa. You can follow us on Instagram at Profiler Africa. Join our Facebook group or drop us an email at profilerafricainfo@gmail.com. And we'll see you again soon. Thank you for listening. And please do share and subscribe and like and do all the things that, you know, you connected people are good at doing. And we'll speak soon.
Cheers, everybody. Thank you.
Rest easy.